1:30. Let's get started. We are in Yeshaya, the beginning of Perek Tet Zayin, chapter 16. By way of recap, am I audible back there? By way of recap, we had started the section in chapter 15. Remember that this is part of the series of prophecies regarding 10 enemies. The first one was Bavel, the second one was the Plishtim, the Philistines, and the third one was Moab. And we had said that Moab represents, consistently within Tanakh, a theme of selfishness. And it goes all the way back to Lot, it continues with Sodom, it continues with Moab, descendants of Lot in the story of Ruth. It continues with a whole bunch of events, some of which we discussed last time and the time before that. And there's a prediction of devastation coming to Moab. Remember that Moab is in the area east of the Yarden, east of the Jordan, towards the south. And we get a list of cities of Moab that are in ruins. That was what we saw in chapter 15 as the dominant image. And there was a great display of grief. We talked about the language, not going through that all over again. But the fascinating middle sentence in the chapter was one in which Yeshaya seems to express his own grief for the fate of Moab. And there were different ways to read it. Ibn Ezra and Radak said it's not actually Yeshaya crying, it's Yeshaya quoting Moab. They're crying. The Malvim said his heart is calling out to the warriors, saying, don't do it, don't fight against the Assyrian invaders. But Rashi said, quoting the Medrash, that he's actually crying for the pain of Moab. We talked about that as a trait of the Navi, of the prophet, that he is somebody of mercy. But it was also interesting in light of our mixed relationship with Moab, where on the one hand, they're a terrible enemy, and on the other hand, they're family. And no, those two are not necessarily contradictory. This idea of crying for Moab, one wonders if there's an element of sympathy. Keep in mind, they are also, for all of their terrible traits, the source of Ruth, the source of King David, the source of Mashiach, and that can't really be ignored. The chapter concluded with more of the cries of Moab and a description of the devastation that they experience, and that brings us to chapter 16, and a very interesting section regarding refugees. So we are in Perek Tet Zayin. I actually forgot to pull a Tanakh from the back when I So thanks to Rebecca, I now know we're on page 981.
Because I'm studying Lot in the morning.
Yes.
Lot was also called an immigrant.
Yes. And we had talked about the fact that the Abraham and Sarah take care of Lot. He migrates with them into Canaan, down to Egypt, back out of Egypt. He is an immigrant, so to speak, in Sodom, and that becomes part of this picture as well. So let's see the psukim again, page 981, chapter 16. We're going to look at the opening five psukim, the opening five sentences, and they're not easy, but we'll work through it. Shilchuchar Moshel Eretz Misela Midbara El Har Bat Zion. Send Kar. And Kar, we talked about, I think, a little bit last time, in terms of the challenge of what Kar is. The most simple read is that it's a messenger. They talk about here sending a fatted sheep, is the art school translation based on Rashi. It's not that relevant for us right now, but I'm going to come back to what a Kar is. Just not there yet. Send a Kar, Moshel Eretz, the ruler of the land. Misela Midbara El Har Bat Zion. They should send it to the mountain of the daughter of Zion. From the desert to the mountain of the daughter of Zion, which I would have assumed was Yerushalayim. We're going to come back to that. The Hayacha Of Nodeid Kain Mishulach. He will be like a wandering bird. Like a bird that has been sent, right? Shiluach HaKein, the sending of the mother bird from the nest. Tiyena benot Moab mabarot la'arnon. The daughters of Moab shall be at the crossings of the Arnon being a body of water east of the Yarden. One of the principal boundaries among the tribes that settled there. It's part of the land of Moab. Havi'i Eitzah, Asu Plila. Make a judgment. Take counsel. Shiti halayel tzilech betoch tzaharayim. Cast your shadow like night at midday. Satri nidachim. Noded al tigali. Hide. Give shelter to those who are pushed away. Those who are wandering, don't exile them. Yagu vachnidachai, those of mine who have been pushed away will dwell among you. Moav, have a seter lamo mipnei shodeid. Moav, be a shelter for them before the thief, the bandit, the oppressor. Ki afes hametz kala shod tamu romes min haaretz. Conclusion of pasuk dalet, conclusion of sentence four. The theft, the despoiling, is now done. Those who trampled the land are now gone. And the throne will be established with generosity. He shall sit upon it in truth in the tent of David. The judge, source of justice. And that concludes the section. Anybody have any clue what this was? What are we talking? I don't even know who the refugees are. These psukim seem to be all over the place. It begins with a call to Moab to send Kar. Kar being a sheep, Kar being a messenger, Kar being a ruler. Send it to Tzion. Then, Pasuk Bet, sentence 2, seems to say Moab, who's being addressed with the opening sentence, so Moab is going to be made to wander. The daughters of Moab are crossing the Arnon. So Moab goes into exile. So far, so good. It's a call to Moab to send a gift of some sort to Tzion. Moab is going to be made to wander, but then sentences 3 and 4 are the problem. Because it says, take counsel, extend your shade, your protective shade. At midday, hide those who are refugees. Who are the refugees? The Jews? Why the Jews?
Or people who lived in Moab who aren't Moabites?
I don't know. Why not be the Moabites themselves? They're being sent into exile. So who is being called upon then to shelter Moab? The refugees are Moabite or going to Moab? This is the problem. It's a call to someone to shelter somebody else. Because the oppressor is gone from the land and a great king is going to sit on the throne of David HaMelech. I don't know what you're talking about. So I have three different approaches here. The first two are based on the standard commentaries, and then the third goes a little further afield with it, but I think is accurate. So the first approach I base on Malbim. And what he's saying is, this is a call to Moab to flee to Israel, and we will shelter them under our righteous king. It's a simple narrative. Saying to Moab, you're going to go into exile, you should be on good terms with the Jews, and the Jews will then take care of you. It fits the overall tenor of the section, which is describing the downfall of Moab. So that fits. It also is not looking to form an alliance with Moab. It's saying to Moab, pay tribute to us. Which again is consistent with this whole overall section, which is of Yeshaya saying, all the nations around you are going to collapse, so stop looking to them for support. Just the opposite, they're going to look to you for support. So take a look at source number one. Baliatsam Echi Natsalu. He came to counsel them, Moab, on how they should be saved. Ba'amar She'elem Hatzalan. He said, there is no option of being saved. You have no escape. The only thing you can do, and I'm going to skip into the English because of time. But he says, there is no way for them to escape. The only thing they can do is send a car, an agent, to Jerusalem to ask them to allow them, to allow Moab, to live and take shelter in Judea. And he placed in the mouth of the agent that which he should say to the mountain of the daughter of Tzion, meaning the sentences of, help us, shelter us. The prophet promised the Judeans would have mercy upon them and grant their request, but he saw that Moab in their arrogance would not want to lower themselves to seek salvation from Judea, so he said, they are guilty themselves. It's their own fault. They will not want to make this request. The problem with Malbim's read is that it requires a forced reading of sentences 3 and 4. That's not really what the sentences seem to say. And he does his best with it. The second paragraph in source number 1, I didn't translate it just because of space, but I'm going to tell you what he says. He breaks down sentence 3 into 3 parts. Where sentence 3 says, Havi'i Eitzah, take counsel, Asu Pelilah, make a judgment, Shiti Chalayel Tzilech B'toch Tzaharayim, they set forth your shade like night at midday. So he reads it as, and you can see where I underlined in the Hebrew, that should help you if you want to track the Hebrew. He says, first of all, the nation that needs help says to the nation that has the ability to help, Havi'i Eitzah, give us counsel so that we can win. Show us, in other words, he reads sentence 3 as talking to Moab and telling Moab what to say to the Jews. So Moab, tell the Jews, give us advice for how we can win. Then, Asu Pelilah, practice justice to help us win against our enemy. And then finally, if that's not possible, Shiti Kalayel Tzilech, protect us with your shade like night. That's the idea. So the way Malbim reads sentence 4 is that Yeshaya is giving Moab the words to say to the Jews. It's a tortured read. Susan,
if the word char, it's just a 2-letter
char? Not necessarily. It can be, according to those who are into 2-letter roots, but it could also be tied to a larger verb and simply losing another of the letters. So for example, we sometimes see the term kaf resh used as a verb for acquiring something, right? Like mechira, which is sales. So we use that. Abram says about Marat HaMachpelah, Kariti Li. Right? I acquired it via commerce. Can mean pillow, but not here. No one's sending pillows. Sorry.
Is this the only place we see this word like this in the Tanakh?
We do see the word elsewhere. The question is, which of the elsewheres does it mean? Kar, we often see, meaning sheep. Livshu karim hatzon.
But that's with a bad kuf.
No, with a kaf. With a kaf. Livshu karim hatzon is an example, but it's not the only one, is with a kaf, yeah. Right. Da Mikra tries to connect it to an Arabic term.
Yes.
Da Mikra sitting here. Yes. So they do try to connect it to a word, kirkara, which refers to a wagon, like the wagon that would be bringing the tribute, correct? Yes.
I just don't remember. Was Moab one of the nations that ganged up on Yehuda and killed those trees? Are they mentioned or was it just Aram?
So Aram tries to get Moab on their side as part of that trip that they make down the Yarden, trying to find allies. They go down to Ammon, Moab, Edom, and then arrive to the Plishtim. So that's unclear. I mean, we don't have an explicit reference.
It's hard to understand why would give them any, have mercy on them or help them or give them a plan.
And the answer is, we're suckers. We do that. When people talk nicely to us and ask for help, we tend to send it, no matter what the experience has been before.
This is sometime later, and that's part of our Torah is to be there.
Yeah, but I think there's more. I think there's more to this. When I get to the third approach, you'll see. Debbie, you were going to say?
This is way complex. They say camels, and then they give a whole discourse about what a camel is and desert and
humps. Like somebody drinks a lot of water. Horses don't like them. Yeah. Okay. So that's all one take. Second take is Ibn Ezra. And Ibn Ezra says, no, He also has the problem of sentences 3 and 4. You can't ignore it. And what he does is he flips the story. So that sentences 1 and 2 are saying Moab is going to have to flee. And sentences 3 and 4 say, therefore, Moab, you should shelter our refugees. So that when this happens to you, we'll take care of you. We are going to be refugees before the Assyrians. If you take care of ours, then when Chizkiyahu rises and the Assyrians are dashed against Yerushalayim, then you will have assistance from Chizkiyahu. Take a look at source number 2 at Ibn Ezra. Send a car, a kind of fast camel. There you go. The as in Kings 2, chapter 11, there's your Malachim Bet reference as well. And some say a ruler is described as a car. His step is larger than any other. Car, the idea being something very large, a large expanse of space. It appears correct to say car is linked, meaning linked to the word after it, for it is only found with rulers. In other words, when it says car Moshel, it means car is the ruler himself. But that's not his main point. He says bring, it says bring counsel. Meaning, the prophet addresses Moab, before the trouble befalls you, take counsel yourself. Your shelter. Shelter Israel when they flee to you, when they are pushed from their place. They will live, my refugees. The prophet's words are those of God for the honor of Israel. God is saying, my refugees will live before the despoiler who despoiled Samaria, meaning the king of Assyria. A time will come when this oppressor will be lost and the spoils will end. So the way Ibn Ezra reads it is a statement to Moab, take care of our refugees. That fits better in sentences 3 and 4 because it makes a lot more sense. The Navi is saying to Moab, you will be refugees, and he's continuing to say to Moab, take care of ours, instead of flipping it, where he first says, you will be refugees, and then he says, you should tell the Jews, take care of our refugees. The problem with, and by the way, Radak supports this as well in source number 3. He says it's that you should have sent tribute to us. However, it's still hard. It's still a hard read. It's better. Barbanel and Sudat David have similar ideas. It's definitely better. It's definitely a stronger read. Which is a funny thing to say, because Malbim is usually very, very careful about things like that. But when he has a vision for what he wants to present as a theme, he'll make the sentence work. But a third idea here is that this is an intertextual read of the relationship between Moab and the Jews across history. And while this is sort of my take, Radak has shades of this. Meaning, we said this already last week or the time before, we have a history of helping Moab when they are refugees. Going back to what I had said to Joyce. Abraham and Sarah take Lot along when they leave Haran, right? Lot's father has died. They take Lot with them, and as a consequence, Lot gains. Abraham and Sarah arrive in the land of Canaan. There is a famine. They go down to Egypt. They take Lot with them. Abraham saves Lot, of course, and the refugees of Sodom in the war of the 4 and 5 kings. Abraham's merit saves Lot and Moab in the destruction of Sodom. Yes, it's true that Midrash associates it with Ruth's merit. However, the Psukim themselves say God remembered Abraham and he took Lot out. So I think that's a pretty good basis. And then, further along, Boaz takes in Ruth of Moab. So we have a history of helping the refugees of Moab. Moab, on the other hand, has a history of not helping people in need. They come from Sodom. And when visitors come to Sodom, they are not given a place. They did not want to share resources with us when we came out of Egypt. Remember we talked about this the last class before Pesach, about how they hired Bilaam. They were under no threat from us at all. We were not interested in going to war with them, and they didn't say to Bilaam, we're afraid of war. They said, we are worried that the Jews are going to eat up all the resources. We don't want them moving into the neighborhood because we are not interested in sharing. That was why they took Bilaam and attacked us. So this is a call to Moab. And it's saying to them, purify your ways. Stop being Sodom. if you will take in our needy, as Ibn Ezra says, then your needy will be protected as well. You follow? It's more than just a practical statement of, you scratch our back, we'll scratch yours. You look after ours, we'll look after yours. It's a demand for tshuva. It's saying, change your ways, and then you will be deserving. And my best proof of this is Pasuk Hey, sentence 5. The end of the segment. Look what it says. V'uchan b'chesed kisei v'yashav alav be'emet b'ohel David. The new ruler is going to reign. Where? In the tent of David. David who is?
Moab.
Right? David is the one who came from Moab. So that's the one who is going to be the righteous king who will take you in, but you need to take the step of tshuva, of repentance. That's what I see going on.
I mean, I don't know. Personally, I find it hard. I mean, it's one thing to take the example of a few hundred years earlier when the Jews were returning from Mitzrayim and that happened. But to take those individual cases when there was or there wasn't a Moab.
But that's what Tanakh does over and over again. That's the thing. In other words, you're right. You're right from a contemporary perspective. Meaning today, we are opposed to the idea of identifying people based on a race, right? And stereotyping and so forth. That's no longer popular thinking.
Or almost a prerequisite. I mean, because you're talking about...
But this is what Tanakh does consistently. Tanakh identifies people by their genealogy.
Upon the children. It's visiting the sins of the father upon the children. Which I thought we're opposed to.
Except when we're not. No, because the answer is that from a Tanakh perspective, it is not a matter of punishing them for the sins of their parents. It's that the assumption is they're going to continue the ways of their parents until they demonstrate otherwise. The Knanim, who we meet when we come into the land, are assumed to be the same as Ham. Even though Ham is, the whole discussion of who Ham is, but Ham is the father of Canaan. I think it's Ibn Ezra who comments. The reason why we are told the story about Ada and Sila and Lemech, the reason why we are told the story about Noach and his drunkenness and what Canaan does, is to say, here are your neighbors. This is who we're talking about. This is who you're going to get to know. This is what Canaan is. There are ages and ages before. Doesn't make a difference. The assumption is that descendants carry on the traits of their ancestors for good and for bad until you see them do otherwise. Yeah?
Well, I was going to say that the blessings of Yaakov on his children sort of assume that they're always going to be that way. That those tribes are, you know, that whatever Reuben did that was wrong, he blessed the... for the rest of for millennia,
right.
Forever, and that Shimon and Levi are always going to be hot headed, and I don't know. There's just a sort of an assumption there that certain traits are going to carry on.
Right.
Is that why we're so obsessed with Yichus?
In part, yes. Not that they will always be, but that's the default. That's the canvas against which they operate. But absolutely 100% true. We just did it in the Shmuel class at Alina's house. We talked about the introduction of Shaul. Shaul is introduced with like 6 generations of lineage in order to make the statement of, look who his ancestors are. This one is a Gibor Chayil. Therefore, we assume he's going to be a Gibor Chayil as well. You were here, I think, when we did Ezra Perek, Zayin Perek Chet, when we introduced Ezra for the first time, we gave him 15 generations. So I pointed out when we were discussing this regarding Shaul, but it's true for Ezra and true for others as well, the Torah stresses when it gives us the command for choosing a melech. It stresses something very interesting. What are the criteria for being king? What does the Torah tell you a king has to be? Very little. The only instruction it gives you is mikerav achecha, from among your brethren. Don't take a foreigner.
And he can't have too many.
No. Criteria for being a king. I'm not talking about the rules for governing. I'm talking about what qualifies you as a king. Then you have to be Mikarav Achecha. So they have to prove it. Here's your lineage.
With Herod?
Yeah, what's a foreigner?
Oh, Herod's got big problems. That's the Gemara.
Here he does the...
Actually, that's Agrippus.
Yeah,
that's Agrippus, not Herod. But the but yes, this was an issue then. That's why these weren't legitimate kings. But really, they weren't asking our opinion. The Romans, by and large, didn't particularly care. So they didn't necessarily have to be from the Davidic line. The command originally given was not to be from David, and in fact Shaul was not from David. Right? Why that's so? Ramban versus Abarbanel, not for right now. Susan.
I know this is law, but you're talking about generation. Why then is the Munzer who...
Yeah, this is way off from our conversation. You're right.
You said, you know, you can't assume that he's going to be bad yet forever. He's a...
Right. The discussion about Mamzer is a good discussion, but entirely not for right now. We will never get back to this. Not this week and not next week. It's a good discussion, but not for the moment. So the call here is indeed for historic Moab to change its ways. Because whatever the belief is about what the ancestors have done, the assumption is that the Mamzer, to use your case, is able to change. The Gemara says, Mamzer Tamid Chacham comes before a Kohen Gadol Am Haaretz. Right? The Mamzer, who is a Torah scholar, precedes the Kohen Gadol, who is ignorant. It's always going to come down to merit in the end. But the canvas against which you operate is the lineage. So let's go further now, please. To the rest of Perek Tzayin, the rest of chapter 16. So, Pasuk Vav, sentence 6. Again, we're still on page 981. And here, the chapter becomes a lot more smooth. We spent the first chapter about Moab in chapter 15 talking about the cities being in ruins. Now we see the land of Moab, the land agriculturally, being in ruins. And a lot of it is general destruction. But there's something else that's going on here that's fascinating, and I'm going to rely on you to have read ahead the way that we always ask for people to do. So I'm not going to do it word by word. But I want to highlight something for you. Sentence 7, okay, chapter 16, sentence 7, talks about Ashishei Kir Chareshet. Kir Chareshet is a city, but Ashishei. Ashishim are what?
Cakes?
That's an interesting term. So, Ashishim is used in different ways. Some take it as walls, some take it as foundations. However, it is often taken as a grapevine term. Here they do it as the foundations. They're taking Rashi, which, you know, is normal for Art Scroll. But Ashishim are often Ashishei Anavim, the grapevine related. But take a look at sentence 8 where it becomes much more explicit. Shadmot Cheshbon. Shadmot are very clearly vineyards. Geffen Sivma, the grapevine of Sivma. These are all cities. Cheshbon is a city, Sivma is a city. And then finally, Sirukeha. Sorek is... What is a Sorek? We saw it back in chapter 5, sorry. It's also a grapevine. It's a young grapevine. It's a good vine in particular. The Vlasoreka Beniatono we find in Yaakov's Brachot. And then in sentence 9, you find another reference to Geffen Sivma, the grapevine of Sivma, one of the Moabite cities. And then in sentence 10, last sentence in this piece, we talk about as well the Kramim, we talk about the Yekavim, the Yekav is the press, as well as Kirchar, as well as, the Lo Yidroch HaDorech, the Dorech, the one who tramples the grapes. This is all grapevine imagery. That's what he uses to describe the destruction of Moabite agriculture. Why use the grapevine as an image in particular? Radak notes that grapes are associated with joy, and here they're associated with pain and crying. I would note there's a Gemara in Yuma that says that wine is called yayin because wine brings yilala, which is one of those words that's onomatopoeic, right? Ululation. Right. Yilala is wailing, crying. So yayin is like the kind of a whining word. But more, Moab grew grapes. I brought you on the sheets a link to source number five. That's one link of many where you can find out all about the grapevines of Jordan today. They have volcanic soil, and it's considered to be a good place to grow grapes. But more than that, I gave you a reference there, Devarim 32:32. Anyone know that one? I've got at least one Baal Kriya here. From his favorite parsha too. Devarim 32:32. Okay, you can look it up. It is page 509. Kimi Geffen Sidom Gafnam. Right? Kimi Geffen Sidom Gafnam Umishadmot Amora. God is speaking of those who rebel against him. Unclear in context who it actually is. It's the Jews or their enemies. But it doesn't matter for our purposes. What does matter is, the image is, their vineyard is the vineyard of Sodom, and from the fields of Amora. Sodom and Amora are associated with the grapevine. So that it isn't so much necessarily that the region has grapevines, but it's associated biblically with Sodom. So when he's criticizing Moab, yes, again, he's going all the way back. Moab was known for the fertile land. That's why Lot chose it in the first place. And that's what's marked now to their downfall. Rashi actually makes a comment, which, did I bring it on here? Yeah, look on your sheet, it's source number 6. Rashi compares it to their downfall. He says, Shadmot ha-gefen v'sorei kan yizkarim kan einam al ha-mashal. He says the whole thing is a parable, fundamentally. V'machanot v'siot b'imei ha-amim ha-ele. He says, these are really just a parable for the camps and caravans of Moab that are going to be destroyed, and that I think is fairly clear as you read through the passage, and it talks about them crossing the sea. Grapevines don't usually extend across the sea. But then it moves into sentence 6, and I love sentence 6. Chapter 16, six was actually from the beginning of the section, but this is such a great sentence. Why do I love this sentence? What's so wonderful about this sentence? It's the sound. It's Yeshaya having fun again. The Shamanu Geon Moav Gei Meod Gavaso Ugeono. Right? You hear it. The G sound, Geon Gei Gava Gaon. It's a great play, but I also think it's a pun. I think Yeshaya is playing games. In Hebrew, what is a gay? Gimel Yud or Gimel Yud Aleph? What does the word mean?
Valley.
It's a valley or a low-lying area, right? Moshe is buried. Vayikboro to Bagai, right? In Mizos Abracha. He buried him in, it's translated either as a depression, a low-lying area, or a valley, depending on which chumash. But on the other hand, the word gay, Gimel Aleph, Ge'ah, Ga'on, Gava, is a term for height, for power, to be lofty. Ashir al Hashem, ki Ga'o Ga'ah, right? So, in the context of Moab, Moab has low-lying areas in the plains, as well as the areas that are around the streams that run into the Yarden. Ge'ah means both to them. On the one hand, they are very arrogant and they hold themselves up. And on the other hand, they have these very low-lying areas. And what he's trying to say here, despite their arrogance, Moab is actually very low. They pretend to be Gaon, Gay, Gay-eh, but they are actually the low-lying Gimel Yud Aleph instead. So I think that's what Yeshaya is doing. I think it's a beautiful piece of language that he's doing. Yes. One might argue that that's at the core of, compensation. Agreed. So they hold themselves to be very lofty, but in fact, they are very low. And then the end of that sentence, of sentence 6, Lo chein badav, is a very hard set of words to translate. Not so badav. So I take Radak's view there. Badav, to be bodeh, is to do what? What is it? To make something up. Exactly. To make something up. That's the way Radak takes it in source number 7. Lo emet k'sava k'zavav. His lies are not true. Klomar dvarav shayim medaber b'geuto. The things he said in his arrogance, lo nitkaimu ata shabai lavarah. They said all sorts of things about how powerful they were, and in the meantime this befell them, and now they are crushed. The grapevines are destroyed, causing Moab to wail. Interesting note, the cities that are mentioned here include cities which we took from them when we entered Israel. Meaning, if you look at sentence 8, it mentions Cheshbon. Cheshbon was one of the cities that we took from the Amori. The Amori had taken it from Moab. We took it from the Amori. Yazer, also in sentence 8, and then again in sentence 9. Sentence 9, Cheshbon and El Alei. These are cities which Reuven and Gad talk about. When they come to Moshe and say, we want the land east of the Yarden, they list off a whole bunch of cities. Atarov, V'divon, V'yazer, V'elalei, V'cheshbam, V'vo, V'on. So many of them are listed here as cities of Moab that are going to be destroyed. So our sages looked at that and explained that what's happening here is that when the Jews get kicked out, Reuven and Gad are the first victims of the Assyrians. The Assyrians come in from the east. They in one of their invasions, but they came in from the east northeast. They get rid of Reuven and Gad, and Moab comes into the vacuum. Because remember, the Assyrian method is to transfer populations. So they come into the vacuum and take those cities. And at that point, we're saying to them, you may have taken the cities, but you should know you're going to lose them. That's what Yeshaya is saying, according to this read of various commentators. The only weakness in this, or not weakness, but the thing that makes it remarkable, is that, of course, none of that has happened yet. The audience Yeshaya is speaking to at this stage in the book is an audience that hasn't met the Assyrians yet. Or so we think. It's unclear, to be honest, meaning the previous one we dated as being the first year of Chizkiyahu's reign. It's unclear where the Assyrians are at this point, but from the sound of the flow, the Assyrians have not yet come, which means that those cities are still Jewish cities. And what Yeshaya is then saying is, Moab is going to take these cities back, and then God is going to take these cities back from Moab. And he's just calling the shots for the future, which Yeshaya likes doing. And we're going to see him do it in a more stark way shortly. But it's an interesting thing to see. And again, the question of who the audience was for these prophecies, was it just his students and it was written down later, is still an open question.
Yeah. I'm very confused by that, because usually I'm not going to discuss things with the audience in order to cause change in that audience.
Yes.
Does he expect the Moabites to change? Is he expecting anyone to make any changes here?
Right. So So what we've been saying since the beginning of his addresses to the nations is that this is a statement to us about those nations. That his argument to Ahaz, which continues to Chizkiyahu, is stop looking for allies in the nations around you, turn to God. And what he's been saying here is all of these nations who surround you in the region are going to fall, and therefore you're wasting your time trying to make alliances with them.
But he goes into such detail about these nations.
Oh yeah, he wants it to be vivid. He wants the Jews to envision.
Don't make friends with them. They're going to be in trouble.
Yeah, he's tried that. He tried that with Ahaz. Where to get him?
Okay.
He wants this to be a graphic image that they're not apt to forget.
That's what I'm thinking, that maybe he's thinking that he can cause some behavioral changes in the Moabites themselves.
Right.
Is this in any way contemporary advice?
Oh, yes.
That we shouldn't want to rely too much. I mean, Israel's making connections to the Gulf States and Saudi Arabia.
Right. So I'll go back to what I said to Dahlia before in a separate context, which is yes until it's not. Meaning, one of the things that we talked about ages ago, this had to be like in the second or third month of the year, was that, maybe the third, Ahaz comes from a history among the Davidic line of making alliances with the nations around us. Shlomo made alliances with the nations around us. Yehoshaphat made alliances with the nations around us. And so his argument can be, we've done it. But Yeshaya is saying to him, it's a mistake, don't do it. And you're right, this causes tension, and we're going to see that again with Chizkiyahu. This is an issue. This is a problem. It's not as though you could really say cut and dry, never do it. One thing you can say is never do it as your anticipated support. It's one thing to make an alliance with them for trade. It's another thing to say, this is an alliance for defense. We're going to pay you tribute in order for you to defend us. It's very different. There's criticism that Yirmiyahu offers in Echa for the alliances the Jews attempted to make with Assyria and Egypt against the Babylonians. And he invokes the trade image also. But it seems like the issue is really looking to them for your support as opposed to having relationships. I gave a share on this on Sunday in a different context. We're talking about the state of Israel, whether you are supposed to be a nation that dwells alone or an international partner. It's also a question in its own right. So he says, tears are going to replace joy. In sentence 9, Al kein evkeh bivchi yazer, he says, I will cry with the tears of Yazer. And once again, just like in the previous chapter, we have a debate as to, is this the prophet actually crying for Moab? Rashi, just like in 15.5, says it's the prophet crying. Ibn Ezra, just like in 15.5, says no, it's Moab crying. And then you get to a word that I learned as a kid, but, you know, in youth groups, and I didn't know what it meant. They did try to explain it at one point. Yeah, other people here must be familiar with the Yechi Heidad thing.
Yeah.
Right? For sure. Like, so I grew up hearing that. Well, here is Heidad. In Pasuk Tet, Pasuk Yud. The end of sentence 9. Ki al keitzech val kitzireh Heidad nafal. Heidad has fallen upon your harvest and upon your end. And then in sentence 10, joy has left the Carmel. There's no more singing among the vineyards. Wine in the presses shall not be trampled by the Dorech, the trampler. Heidad hishbati. God says, I got rid of Heidad. So Heidad, as used here and elsewhere in Tanakh, is an exuberant exclamation. That's what it's meant to be, like a cheer. And it was used, if you go with the Tanakh references, in two cases. In trampling grapes, as noted here, but also in Yirmiyahu chapter 25 and in Yirmiyahu chapter 48, presumably as like a chant for rhythm. You know, hey dad, as they stamp the grapes. Maybe they're also imbibing a little bit, I don't know. And then the conquerors use hey dad here, as well as, again, Yirmiyahu chapter 25, Yirmiyahu chapter 51. And so here it's understood in two ways. In sentence 9, Hadad has fallen upon you. The enemy's Hadad has fallen upon you, and therefore I've gotten rid of the Hadad. I've gotten rid of the Hadad of your people who are processing the grapes. The Hadad of the enemy has eliminated your Hadad. Which again is Yeshaya with his ear for language. It's just beautiful the way he does that. The one other piece in this, in sentence 11, he says, Me'ai l'Moav kakinor yehemu. My innards from Moav will moan like the kinor. A kinor is a string instrument, right? Sorry? So I've heard it translated as a violin, a lyre, a harp, a guitar. It's a stringed instrument. What kind of string instrument? You tell me. But it's a string instrument. So take a look at what Malbim does in source number 8. He says, don't just take it as, okay, wails like a string instrument. He says, no. Hitzig b'mashalat ha-kinor. He gave the kinor as illustration. Yedamez b'nei me'av la-hameit tarim sha'alehem yifrot. He's comparing his innards to the strings that one plays. And then, chalal gufo, the hollow of his body, is like the hollow in whatever the stringed instrument is, from which the sound is heard. So it's the image of the me'ayim crying, which is something we see elsewhere in Tanakh, is an image of a string instrument. And the sentence that ends this is sentence 12. In which he says, and this is one of those areas where you suffer for the fact that we do this over multiple weeks, so you can lose what the sentence is doing. The last sentence here in the section, When it becomes apparent that Moab is nil'ah on the bama, nil'ah is to be exhausted. On the bama, bama, today we use it to mean a stage, but it was an altar. It was a place where you worshipped. Uva el mikdasho lihitpalel, Moab will come to their sanctuary to pray, velo yuchal, and they won't be able to do so. What is this sentence doing here? What does it have to do with anything? It's doing something brilliant, but again, because we take so long doing the chapters, we lose it. Go back to chapter 15, sentence 2. How did this section open? The section began with them going to the Bama, with them going to their sanctuary to cry out to their God. And so he says in the end, they can't even do it. They can't do that anymore. They are so crushed that they cannot even appeal to their God. And I think that's one piece of it. I think there's another piece also, and now that one I feel pretty good about. Like that I think is shot. I think that's a straightforward thing. But I'd add a dimension to it. We talk so much in this chapter about wine and grapes, which normally disqualify one from prayer. Right? Normally, you have the wine. You're not allowed to go in and pray. He's saying here, even though they don't have any wine, they're not intoxicated, they still can't go pray. An image which we find elsewhere, Yeshaya or Yirmiyahu, I think Yirmiyahu, Shechurat velo miyayin, intoxicated but not from wine. So they still can't pray, even though they lack the wine. In any case, he has now said, Moab, you've been no good from the start. If you change your ways, you can improve, and then you can be sheltered. But either way, you're losing your cities, chapter 15, you're losing your land, and perhaps the prophet sheds some tears over it, depending on how we understand those references. But he has one more message to go. Sentences 13 and 14. Zeh davar asher diber Hashem el Moav me'az. This is what God has said to Moab since then. Well, what then is, we'll come back to. And now, God says it. He said it then, and He says it now. B'shalosh shanim kishnei sachir. How do you translate those words?
3 years.
I'm sorry?
Within 3 years,
like the years of somebody who is hired to do a job. That's a legitimate translation. It's not the only one. How else could you do it? Anyone have a different translation in front of them? They do the same in art school. In 3 years, like the term of a hired hand. There's one other way to do it. We'll see. So he says, sorry?
Can it be in 3 years? Or?
Well, that's what, yeah, that was what we had said.
No, but it's been 3 years. She said it's in, as in past tense.
Oh, no, I think she said within.
Within.
Yeah. In 3 years, we'll take it that way for now, but we'll see another way to do it. In 3 years, like the years of a hired hand, v'nikla kivod Moav, the honor of Moav will be brought to shame. Bechol ha'amon harav, in all the multitudes. Ushar ma'at mizar, lo kabir. What's going to remain? Nothing from nothing. The smallest of the small. They had a lot, Hamon Harav, and now, Ma'at Mizar Lo Kabir, they're not going to be mighty, very little will be left. So first of all, this Me'az thing, right? God said it Me'az, and now He is saying it as well. So there are two approaches here, which Rashi brings. If you take a look at source number 9, Rashi brings both. Number one, the first approach, for a long time before evil befell him. Yeshaya prophesied this. In other words, a long time that God's been saying this. And this is part of God calling the shot, right? Demonstrating that everything is known to Him. The other possibility, though, is, once again, going back to Moab's history. Me'az me'ed asher sachar Balak et Bil'am. From when Balak hired Bil'am. Fine. 3 years and out. So two approaches. One approach, which is the one you've quoted already, is Rashi's second approach in source number 10, which is to say, 3 years, and then that's it. But 3 years like those of a hired worker. What is the comparison to a hired worker?
A hired worker only works
Good. So the we're going to get to that as an added idea in Ibn Ezra, but I'm not quite there. The first approach is to say that what he's saying is 3 years precisely. Like when you hire somebody, you say, I'm going to work X number of days, and that's what you pay him for. 3 years, like the years of a hired worker. There actually is a pasuk in Chumash, which talks about an Eved Ivri, the Jewish slave. And it says, he worked for you for 6 years, Mishneh Sechar Sachir, double the years of a hired worker. And so that gives room for the idea that sort of the normal period of being a hired worker as opposed to a slave is 3 years, which has halachic ramifications, believe it or not. But here, that's not what it means. Because we'll see Yeshaya in chapter 21 talk about 1 year like that of a sachir. It means precision. That's one take. As I said, Rashi brings it. The only problem with this is that we don't know the date of this prediction. We don't even know which devastation we're talking about for Moab. Rashi thinks it's Nebuchadnezzar, although almost everybody seems to think it's Sancheiriv and the Assyrians. But it's weird to say this is a prediction of in 3 years Moab is going to collapse. That's hard. So a second approach, Rashi's first approach, comes from the Medrash in Seder Olam. Take a look at source number 10, the first approach in Rashi. Bishvil shalosh shanim shesiu et Sancheiriv kishetzar al shomron. The Moabites helped Sancheiriv when Sancheiriv besieged the Shomron, besieged the northern kingdom. Vazaruhu below Betzah, they helped him without even taking a profit from the spoils, as though they were sechirim. They're just people who were hired to do a job. And therefore, this is going to happen to them. Rashi gets this idea, or the Medrash really in Seder Olam, gets this idea, because of Malachim Bet, chapter 17, sentence 5. So if you just flip the pages to page 920-something. Is it 925? Nope, 923.
Kings 2,
chapter 17, sentence 5. You see it? So here we are told, Vayal Melech Ashur b'chol ha'aretz, the Assyrian king ascended throughout the land. Vayal Shomron, he went up to Samaria. Vayotzar Alea Shalosh Shanim, he besieged it for 3 years. So that's where the Medrash gets this idea. Oh, there's a 3-year reference. There's a 3-year siege. So the key here to understand this, and this is why I made the point of asking how you translate the words that Yeshaya used, Bishalosh Shanim Kishnei Sachir, not in 3 years, but because of 3 years. Bi doesn't have to mean in. Bi can mean because of, due to the 3 years. That's the idea. Which fits the idea then that Moab is being punished not only for sins of old, but also for what they've done now. They've also harmed us at this point. So that's a second approach. Third idea is from Ibn Ezra. Doesn't contradict either of these, but just an interesting read, and Susan anticipated it. Take a look at source number 11. Hashem gila ze hasod ki shalosh shanim nisharu. God revealed this secret that 3 years remain. So he's taking that view that it's 3 years until. V'tam kishnei sachir, the meaning of, like the years of a paid worker, shekol yom yivaser nafsho matay agia akeitz. Every day he counts the days. He wants to know how long it is until he's able to stop. So too the prophet rejoices, saying, 3 years, like a worker. Counting down the days until it will end. So to summarize what we've done here in chapters 15 and 16, we foretold the destruction of Moab's cities, the destruction of their land. Moab stands for selfishness for us in general. And that's the rebuke that's offered toward Moab, but again, really for the Jewish audience. It's emphasized via the imagery of Sodom. First in the beginning of chapter 15, where we emphasize the suddenness of the devastation like that of Sodom. Then the flight to Tsoar that we saw in chapter 15, sentence 4, and this is very worth going back to take a look. If you have doubts about the association with Moab's ancient history, go back to chapter 15, sentence 4, where we talked about them fleeing to Tsoar, just like Lot fled to Tsoar. Then in chapter 16, in the beginning of it, taking care of refugees, like Abram took care of Lot. And then finally, the grapevines associated with Sodom and Amorah. And the message that comes with it is to repent. The Navi may be seen to cry for Moab twice, once in 15:5, and then again in 16:9-11, emphasizing a trait of mercy and ambivalence that comes with the fall of the relative. And at the end, God calls the shot of their destruction, which may be a prediction of what's going to happen in 3 years. Susan.
That part of the family, so to speak. What does it matter? It's like, is it more important to be good to refugees or war family? Like, is there a concept of refugees who aren't family?
Yes. The Gemara in Bava Metzia talks about the fact that when the Torah presents the mitzvah of tzedakah, it talks about first, achicha, aniecha, evyoncha, asher be'artzecha. From which we understand that your first obligation is immediate family, achicha, your brother, then the local needy, aniyeircha, and then from the rest of the land. And so we understand that there is an order of priority that begins with family and then proceeds outward. There is such a concept. Okay, we have like 2 minutes left. So what I want to just mention to you in introducing the next unit, Prakim Yud Zayin Yud Chet, chapter 17 and 18, are going to speak of the fall of the Syro-Ephraimite alliance, meaning Aram, which is Damascus, which is Syria, and Ephraim, the northern kingdom. They're going to be grouped together. Now, Aram has a long history, of course, with us, going all the way back to Lavan, going back to, you know, Avraham's people. But it seems fairly clear that that's not what this is about. This is about the political alliance that they formed with Ephraim against Ahaz in the south. And indeed, Rashi does something really unusual here. It's worth taking a minute to see this, and then we'll pick up from it next week. But take a look at this Rashi, because it was really surprising to me. Number 12, please. Rashi is troubled because, and you know what? Let me do it outside of the Rashi, because otherwise we have to see other things first. Rashi says that the Medrash talks about punishing Aram and mentions them alongside Ephraim, the northern kingdom, because they were idolatrous. Their common sin is not allying themselves. Their common sin is idolatry. And just jump to the end of that Rashi, and he says, "Vani mefarsho lefi pshat ha-mikra," but I explain it per the simple message of the text. He quotes you the Medrash in order to say, I am not going in that direction. What direction am I going? Shenitchabru ritzin ufekach ben Ramalyahu yachad. The fact that they made this alliance politically, that's clearly the sin for which they are going to be punished here, and we'll talk about it more, God willing, next week. Thank you.